Hi.
Hi.
How are you? Hi. Hi. I've come over here to tell you one thing. Okay, more than one, but basically one thing. I want you to look around. Can you look around for me in this church? You see all the people? Yeah? I'm going to tell you something very special about those people. But not only is it special about them, it's special about you. Every person
is special.
That's right. Thank you. I needed that. Every person in this church loves you more than you will ever know. And you know what that means? That means that in this space with all these people, you will always have a home, and you will always have grown-ups who are going to be old-ups as we get older, who are going to love you just for who you are. That's right. Did you know that? Well, I wanted to remind you. Is there anybody in here that disagrees with me? No. You are loved. And I just wanted you to know that. You can go back to your coloring, Kathy. Thanks for sitting here. This stole that I'm wearing was given to me by a dear friend who is my spiritual director for years, and it was created in Palestine. I love it, and I wear it on the most special of occasions. I wear it for memorials and funerals. I was starting a new sermon series for Lent. As you saw on the marquee and as in your bulletin, it's called The Sin of Shame. And Jim Price said to me, "Don't you mean the shame of sin?" I went, "Nope, the sin of shame." Although today I think I'm going to call it shame and another shooting. We read the story of Jesus getting baptized today. And it appears as a mystical experience, doesn't it? One of God literally choosing Jesus and letting him and everyone else around him know that he is beloved. And I don't know if that was your experience of baptism, if you even remember your experience of baptism or recall it or have some sort of knowledge of what it meant. But this sacrament is more than just somebody joining another group who ascribe to the same values or the same understanding of Christianity or whatever. It's a bigger ritual than that. It's actually the act of joining something itself that is most potent, the act of becoming a part of something, of belonging, a community, a beloved congregation, a group of people that care for one another no matter what. Jesus functioned in a community, and it's not just because he needed somebody to talk to and listen to his crazy ravings, right? We are bioneurologically wired to be in community with one another. We do our best, our most sacred, our most vulnerable, and our most difficult work in community. Sometimes so much so that it scares the boogers out of us. The traditional meaning of baptism, I think, has been disruptive and hurtful. Many traditions, including my own, would panic if a baby had not been baptized before death. Should that baby die before baptism, they were considered to be in a place of limbo. Limbo, which literally comes from the definition of on the edge of hell, with the possibility of redemption, but also on the edge. This was an attempt of the church to try to reconcile the innocence of the child with the theology of original sin, that we are all basically born bad and marked with the sign of a sinner, requiring the sacrifice of Jesus to save us from ourselves. I call this bad theology. It's the same theology they ask the question that we've probably been hearing and seeing all over this place a week, and we've heard and saw it before, and we will again. God, why do you allow such horrible things to happen in our world? As if God, God's self, took an automatic weapon to it, into a school, and once again shot the place up, leaving more dead children in the wake. Now, to the church's credit, in 2007, 8 years ago, the Catholic Church, thank you, you're the only one that got that, dismissed the idea of limbo, stating that the innocent should not teeter on the pit of hell because they were just that. They were innocent. And yet, our children today seem to be teetering right on that pit, don't they? You see, baptism really isn't about cleansing the sinner, but rather it is about creating a place to call home for all of us. In our tradition, this ritual is one of sacred connection between those of us who trust God's love for us and those who desire to be connected with one another, to belong to one another. Brené Brown is a sociologist. She is a social worker, she is a professor, and she has done innumerable amounts of research on shame and vulnerability. In fact, she would state that connection and vulnerability are the cornerstones of this whole series that I'm attempting to do, and on the topic that I tried to avoid today and just really couldn't. She talks about shame as being the unraveling of connection. That shame is defined, get this, as the profound fear of being disconnected. Disconnected from others, and I would contend, therefore, disconnected from God. According to Brown, it asks this insidious question: is there something about me that if others see it, I wouldn't be worthy of connection? I think it's more of a statement. There is something about me that if others, people saw it, they wouldn't want to be connected to me. This shame manifests itself in a number of ways, and we will indeed spend time taking a look at that over the next couple of weeks. But it especially manifests itself differently according to gender. Again, we'll spend more time. But usually in women, you see this manifested: depression, OCD, anxiety, eating disorders, addiction. Men, also addiction, but also it manifests externally: sense of inadequacy, impotency, danger, anger, and rage. I wrote a really good introductory sermon about this sermon series, outlining how it is that shame has alienated us from each other and from ourselves, not to mention from God. The intro today certainly is in keeping with where we will eventually go, but try as I might, I couldn't ignore the obvious example of the shame that we have seen this past week, once again, in our nation. This toxic example of one who is probably experiencing a deep-seated sense of shame and a sense of being disconnected, the epidemic of being disconnected, not accepted, of being fearful, angry, full of rage, and the access to the weapon of choice for fearful, angry, and disconnected people, the automatic. We have all heard the tired, God, so tired, old arguments of why he did what he did. This particular, I don't know, excuse of the month is mental illness, and I promise you, it's not that simple. In fact, as a therapist and one who has been diagnosed with a mental illness, I really want to express my anger on how this minimizes and stigmatizes an entire population of those who are crazy and not to be trusted. And this careless stereotyping just further alienates an already disconnected people. You are sick, and therefore the rest of us fear you, is what it says. So don't come near me. Don't share your story. Don't ask for understanding or empathy. Don't seek treatment for a fulfilling life, but you go buy a gun and I'll go buy a gun and we'll be safe and disconnected from one another even more than we are now, furthering our isolation, intensifying our fear, and embedding our shame. This is not a mental health issue. This is a systemic shame issue. And like all issues, it will require time dismantling. But it also requires triage and immediate attention in order to keep the infection from spreading and from those who are affected to die from the symptoms. After all, we treat the bleeding so that a person doesn't die of a symptom while still seeking a cure for the underlying cause of the bleeding. The illness of shame and disconnection is epidemic. The symptom of rage, the ridiculousness, the ease, the availability of weapons of mass destruction is what needs our immediate triage and our immediate treatment. And so we have to address the symptom that manifests itself in the murder of our children. So now I turn to our denomination because I find that many times I can't find the word to appropriately state what I'm thinking. And yet, the wisdom of our denomination offers that to us. And so, I would like to refer to an article written by Connie Larkin of the National Office in an interview with Tracy Blackman. Among the many fabled and accomplished tribes of East Africa, there is no tribe considered to have warriors more fearsome or more intelligent than the mighty Maasai. The tribe is unique and popular due to their long preserved culture. Despite education, civilization, and Western cultural influences, the Maasai people have clung to their traditional way of life, making them a symbol of Kenyan culture. So it's not surprising then to learn that the traditional greeting passed among the Maasai warriors is Kasarian Anjerai, translated, "And how are the children?" It is their traditional greeting used today. And this greeting acknowledges the high value that the Maasai people place on children's well-being. Even warriors with no children of their own give the traditional answer, "All the children are well," meaning that peace and safety prevail. The priorities of protecting the young and the powerless are in place, that the Maasai people have not forgotten their reason for being, their proper function, and their responsibilities. "All the children are well" means life is good. It means the daily struggles of existence, even among the poor and marginalized, are seen, that the village is committed to providing proper care for those incapable of providing for themselves. So the question I invite us once again today, in the shadow of yet another mass shooting, this time at the high school in Broward County, Florida, is, how are the children? How are the children who are held hostage as terror and gunshots ran through the school, leaving 17 dead? How are the children who are afraid to attend school today, traumatized by a fear of dying in a place that should always be safe? How are the 46 children who are shot daily, 7 of whom will die? How are the children who find guns they believe to be toys until their play ends in the death of a family and friends? How are the children that deal with that guilt? How are the broken ones, like this 19-year-old shooter, whose life can be redeemed but not restored, because access to assault weapons and magazines have forever closed the door to undo what has been done? How are the children sacrificed on our capitalistic altars of self-protection? How are the children? Do we care about our children enough to do all that we can to keep them safe? The ones killed in preventable violence and those left behind to mourn their passing. Imagine what might be the effect on the consciousness of our communities, our nation, and our world if we began greeting one another with the same daily question of the Messiah. How are the children? How might this question reframe our conversation around sensible gun control? How are the children? How many school shootings will it take before the need to protect our children supersedes the greed of our national leadership? This week's massacre brings a total of school shootings, that is, shootings that happened on school grounds, to 18 in the first 46 days of 2018. How many more children, how many more tears, how many more prayers before we regulate guns and take our children out of harm's way? How many children must die before we acknowledge our children are not well? I wonder if we heard this greeting of the Messiah passed along to one another a dozen times a day, would it begin to make a difference in our collective consciousness and how children are thought of and cared for in this world? I wonder what it would be like if every adult among us, parent and non-parent alike, felt an equal weight of responsibility for the daily care and protection of our children. What would it be like if every presidential address began with the question, Mr. President, how are the children? What if the question were asked of religious leadership, Your Excellency, how are the children? What if our denominations asked this question, how are the children? What if we asked our governors and our mayors and our teachers and our law enforcement and all of our elected officials? And what if we asked ourselves, how are the children? What if we asked the NRA, how are the children? We must be courageous enough to examine our present, to see and not unsee, to hear and not unhear, to do all we can not to hinder by asking ourselves the question, how are the children? All of the children, because our children are not well. We talk about the children being our future, the future of our families, the future of our church, the future of our nation. But if we don't take care of our children now, what kind of future can any of us expect? While angry and fearful and shamed-filled people provide lame and outright fear-filled explanations of why they should keep and use whatever kind of article of murder they think they are entitled to, our future is dying in front of us. Our first question should be taken from the example of the Messiah people. How are our children? Facing our own internalized shame, looking into that which keep us bound up fearfully, and trying to find ways to release our own fears and our own shame so that we may once again feel connected is vital to being able to talk about this. It's vital to being able to ask the question, how are the children? They need us to be free from our shame. They need us to set an example of what it means to be a connected people. They need us to teach them the simple message that they are loved, that they are worthy, that they are wanted, that they are sacred, they are part of, and we can't do that until we know that for ourselves. I implore you to take these next few weeks seriously. Be open and listen and explore those things that keep you bound up so that you can be free from whatever it is that keeps you from being alive, free from any shame you might carry, so that you can ask the children, how are you? And so that we can faithfully and lovingly and protectively look after our children and one another. And the people said,